Steve, thanks. Hi, everybody. It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. Welcome to the show. Should be a good one. All kinds of things, including a couple of press conferences, one by the president, one by Nancy Pelosi. We will cover those, or in either in part or in total. We don't know yet.
That is a good way to set it up.
If they're interesting, we'll run with them. If they don't say anything interesting, you're out. That's how it works now. What are your thoughts from yesterday?
It was exciting. You know, I had a great time voting. I went about 2 o'clock.
Yeah.
Really not a long
not
line
crowded.
At all, but that's the downtime of the day.
Yeah.
And then just went home to wait for the results.
It was explained to me that the busiest point, I voted near my house in Evanston. They said first thing in the morning, the lines were the longest. My guess is people who wanted to get it done before they went to work. That makes perfect sense. I only had a couple of people in front of me. They said it got to about 50 or 60 deep.
Really?
At its busiest, which was a pretty long wait. But good. I mean, the story is that in a lot of places it was a record turnout, that more women voted than any other time in history.
And youngsters.
It was a young vote, too.
Yeah, that's that made a big difference, too.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I was saying on the crosstalk. When election results came out and I wasn't voting, I didn't really pay attention to them. And maybe even my first election, I probably pay attention to them. I'm not a political person. I have a almost 16-year-old and a 19-year-old, and we were all watching George Snuffleupagus, and I'm in love with David Muir.
Are you?
Yeah.
Well, good for you.
I've decided.
He's very lovable. Yeah.
Man.
Sorry, Jimmy. You had a good run. Pack your things.
I was watching the coverage and flipping around, and it was kind of excited.
Yeah.
Exciting, rather. We were all watching and, you know, just to see what happens. Your vote does count.
It was interesting, depending on which station you were watching, and like you, we didn't keep it in one place for too long. I wanted to see what was going on all over the place. The Texas race, depending on what station you were watching, either had Cruz or O'Rourke up at any given time by a couple of percentage points. And sometimes at the exact same time, there were a couple times where I switched and within seconds, one guy was leading the other guy by 2 points, or the other guy was leading the first guy by 2 points.
You know what my takeaway was for everything is you're seeing, you know, their graphics about the House seats and it's getting closer to 50-50,
sure.
And then the Democrats are a little ahead than you didn't know, and the Senate was still pretty close.
Sure.
Wasn't, you know, expected to go the Democrats' way. But what I see with that red and blue is I like having two voices.
Yeah, right. Right.
That was my takeaway from all of this, is this is a democracy.
Yeah. Yep.
So that was pretty exciting.
You said something interesting this morning in that you feel sorry for our former governor.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, if I felt that sorry, perhaps I would have voted for him. But I just, I watched the concession speech.
It was, honestly,
it was a
really good concession speech.
I know, and he looked like he had tears in his eyes. And then I thought, I guess what I really feel sorry for is, look at all that money he spent for nothing.
Yeah, when you stop and think about that, about the millions of dollars to walk away not winning an election. And what that was inevitable. One of them was not going to win after spending countless millions of dollars on an election. We all get buyer's remorse from something. Every once in a while, you'll buy something, you'll take it home, and you'll look at it, and you'll go, I don't know if I needed this. I spent $32 on this. Did I need this? But when you spend millions and millions of dollars on something and walk away with nothing to show for it.
And he seems like a truly nice man. We've had his wife on several times. I like her.
Yeah.
I just am a big softy. I really am. Well, and Erica Harold's concession speech was awesome.
Also very nice.
We had her in, didn't we?
No, I've never talked to her. You might
I could have sworn we had her in.
Yeah. During Bruce Rauner's speech, he mentioned how now is the time to truly come together and not to look at things as a Republican or as a Democrat, but to and that was very inspiring. And I would love for that to happen. I don't know. I can't remember the last time that happened. I'd love for that to happen.
I think Kwame Raoul owes me a little something something because I kept saying I'm Kwame Raoul, and
that's what put him
helped.
Over. That's what they said at the end of the night. They said your impression of him is what put it over,
and your slogans that you came up.
Want some salami? Vote for Kwame. You're not going to lose with something like that.
Like the Who's Tommy?
Right. I also wrote a song, you know, the Blondie song, Call Me? Yeah. I wrote a whole song, Kwame, like that, that was very popular with the kids, Wendy. They were playing it at the nightclubs.
You have too much idle time. Do you know that?
Yeah, I do. I do. Also, I want to congratulate a friend of the show for winning yesterday in Nevada, Dennis Hoff.
I saw that, and I don't know how good a job he's going to do.
He's not taking calls.
He is not taking calls today.
How does that happen, and how does that make the person running against him feel?
For people who are not sure quite what we're discussing, Dennis Hoff, who has been a guest on the show.
He's no friend of mine.
A brothel owner in Nevada. He was running for state assemblyman, and he won by a landslide.
How
like not even close. And he died. He didn't die yesterday.
Yeah, he's
been
dead
for several months. But that didn't stop the people of Nevada for voting for him, which is really, I think,
a true testament to the Nevadaans.
Well,
another stiff in public office.
Oh, good morning, ladies and gentlemen.
But don't you think, much like the election of our current president, where people said, I'm fed up with the system. I got to do something. I can't just keep voting in politicians. These people in Nevada said, we're not getting anything done anyway. Let's vote a dead guy in. And they did. And he won by a lot.
I would like to talk to one Nevadaan who knew he was dead and still voted.
They
for
all
him.
Knew he was dead. Every one of them.
Well, then I don't.
It was no secret. I've been told that it is a rule that once the ballot is printed up, regardless of what happens to you, be it a scandal, be it death, as in this case, it has to happen.
I don't
He's
know
on
that
the
that's
ticket.
True. Steve, maybe you can correct me, but wasn't someone taken off the ballot last year and last election? Wasn't there some kind of little form that was passed out at all the voting places? The polling places. I don't remember who it was, but then there was a mistake and they were on the ballot.
Here's what it says. It goes down to the laws of Nevada, state law in Nevada. Hoff, a reality television star.
A deceased.
Let's make that clear. A deceased reality star touted as the state's most well-known pimp. That looks good on a business card, by the way. Ran into an outspoken Republican for Nevada's Assembly District 36 before he died in October at the age of 72. Due to a state law, Hoff remained on the ballot, and the state's leading GOP officials had urged voters to still cast their ballots for him in order to deprive Democrats of a chance to flip the seat. So that's the politicians of Nevada saying to people, look, we've got a dead guy running for office, but isn't it better to put him in office than a living Democrat?
That's really bad.
So, well, and then they went for it.
They went for it huge.
Right.
He won by a landslide. Wasn't even close. But what if you're the politician running against him and you lose to a guy that everybody knows is dead but still voted for him, don't you go, maybe politics isn't my calling?
That's what I said. I feel bad for the person who lost to him. I don't understand how that could even happen.
That's when you just say, I got to find something else. The people knew I'm alive and that guy's dead, and they voted for the dead guy over me. This is not for me. All right, let's do this. We'll take
Can
a quick...
Can I just say
yes,
that,
Steve.
That story was sent to me in an email from Ireland this morning.
Really?
And the guy said, I've read this headline 10 times and I still don't understand it.
So do people from other countries, were they paying attention to the midterms?
I would imagine.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah. All right, we've got a bunch of calls. If you're on hold, stay there. We'll get to your calls and your texts next. We're at 312-981-7200. We would love to get your takeaway from yesterday's elections. It's Bill and Wendy on WGN. All right, big election day yesterday. A lot of interesting stories coming out of it. What are your thoughts? We're at 312-981-7200. You can call us or text us there.
Joe has called us. I can't reach the phone.
Oh.
All right, hey,
Joe. Hold on, Joe. There you are.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good. What's up, Joe?
Well, I just want to say I was glad about last night getting Congress. Now we can actually put a check on Donald Trump. And I figured we would lose the Senate,
yeah.
And that was a given.
Yeah.
But I think this is really an important step as far as getting Congress back and starting to stop Donald Trump from going willy-nilly into whatever he wants to do.
It would seem.
But I also wanted to comment on what you guys were saying earlier about feeling bad for Bruce Rauner. I kind of did too, but Bruce Rauner was never going to win this election. I mean, he was put in last time because everybody wanted Pat Quinn gone.
Yeah. Why do you think he would?
One of them.
Why do you think he would have never won? What do you think disqualified him?
Because Illinois is normally a Democratic state. I mean, they've had some good Republican governors in the past, and I voted for them as well.
Yeah.
It's turned completely, I think, a 180 around and gone towards the Democratic side.
Yeah.
Which I'm one of them. I mean, don't get me wrong. I don't disagree with it. But I normally vote the party if I think they have a real good candidate. And that's why I voted Republican last year, or the last term, because Pat Quinn's failing us miserably. And I thought maybe a change would count, but it didn't really help because he wasn't able to get nothing done, and plus he was strictly pushing the Republican agenda.
Absolutely. Joe, thanks so much for the call.
We appreciate it. And speaking about voting for your party, the people in my district, 56,000 people voted with their party and voted for the Nazi guy from Lyons,
Arthur
Jones.
You got a lot of
votes. So you think about that, and I heard Pat Brady talking with Steve Cochran this morning. Those 56,000 people just stuck with the party, and did everyone know that he was a Nazi leader?
I was trying to decipher whether or not they were aware of it or ill-informed in regards to it. There's been plenty of press about this guy's involvement with white supremacist groups. So do you go, that aside, I still think he'd make
for
it. Yeah. It's very confusing to me.
Well, Dan Lipinski beat him, and thankfully so, because do you want a former Nazi leader?
Right.
That's my district, too.
Right,
so,
I get it. A quick highlight from last night. I don't know if you got to see it. Steve, I don't know if you got to see it. Mary, I don't know if you got to see it, but I thought that this was a highlight. Sean Kasdan comes up. He defeated Peter Roskam in the race for Congress. And during his speech, very early on, he thanked everybody for coming out. And he said, I know a lot of you were paid to be here by George Soros, which got a huge laugh, including me.
Yeah, I did hear that.
I thought that was a beautiful highlight. When you talk about feeling bad for whoever didn't win, I know I like to make baseball analogies, but as much as I was pulling for the Red Sox in the World Series, when the World Series was over and they showed the Dodgers sitting in the dugout being sad, I went, oh, it would have been nice if the Dodgers had won. I think it's kind of human nature to look at whoever is not doing the victory dance and going, oh, now how awful this must be for them.
And quite honestly, the acceptance speech from J.B. Pritzker was pretty impressive.
I didn't get to see that. Was it?
It was long.
What did he do?
Yeah, I thought that was a good speech, Wendy.
I hope he sticks to what he said. Let's put it that way.
Was there a moment or two of unity? Because I think that's what needs to be done right now, is some attempt to bring the two parties together. And I know everybody talks about it, but then actually doing it is another story. But I think in that speech, and I didn't get to see it, so I don't know if he did this or didn't do it at all. I mean, it was addressed by Mr. Rauner. He certainly brought it up. So you got to say to everybody, let's try to make this work together.
Pritzker's speech struck me as a joyful speech.
Did it?
It really was.
And which was, I think, really works. And it was a litany of Illinois and Chicago. So, you know, he mentioned, I can't remember specifics now, but he mentioned things about the South Side and Southern Illinois in kind of a fun and joyful way. And he had that line about it wasn't the agony, but the agony of the hill, climbing the hill, and the beauty of the hilltop, you know, and he says, I want people who know both and to feel both and to things like that. I thought it was a good speech.
Can I ask, and Steve Cochran mentioned this early this morning, and I was thinking it as he was saying it, Mr. Pritzker has almost gone out of his way to not be as media friendly as he can be. Do you think that will change, Steve? Do you think he'll make more of an effort?
I don't know the specifics of that. I mean, he's been around here. I don't know if he just doesn't want to be on Steve's show.
Maybe.
Because he was on with Dave Plyer here a couple weeks ago. He was walking the hallways.
Oh, yeah? All right. Good.
Text, JB really knows the struggle. Okay. I know. That's not really true.
Right.
But, you very rarely.
I think he was referring to himself.
Right.
Right. Right. He even said, everybody but me. Maybe if he said that honestly.
A lot of rich people run for governor. Okay. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah.
You need money to.
Well, who were we talking with the other day about that? So there was some guest, and that came up.
Eric Zorn and Daniel Bliss.
It was Eric Zorn that we now live in a day and age where a man or a woman, no matter how well intentioned they are, if they're not really, really, really wealthy, they're not going to get to this stage, and that's tragic.
It is,
you know.
Because part of the time is you want someone who is your everyman or every woman, but it's probably not going to happen.
But not long ago, there were people running for office that whenever they would talk about the problems of today, the price of gas, you go, yeah, I bet any money you have no idea what gas costs, you know, to your richer politicians. Yeah. Their set of problems and our set of problems are very different sets of problems. And I mourn the fact that somebody who really is just one of us, they don't stand much of a chance anymore.
And I have a question about the blue wave that everybody was, you know, hoping for.
It's
and
a Mountain Dew flavor. That's what it is.
I like blue raspberry, so if it has anything to do with it. But it didn't happen according to the results, but didn't it? I mean, I like seeing the red and blue split up between the House and the Senate because our country's a democracy, and I feel like this is the beginning of something.
Yeah.
Well, to continue Bill's analogy, it wasn't a shutout. You know, the Democrats didn't, there wasn't this wave that sort of swept up people who would have been unlikely winners and make them winners.
Right.
You know, so when you see Gillum lose in Texas, or in Florida, when you see Beto O'Rourke lose in Texas, which is a very red state, you know, had there been this huge wave, they might all have been lifted up. Now, having said that, though, it was a big night for Democrats. I mean, they...
A lot of flip-flops.
They took the House. They took, I think, 7 governor's mansions. They did very well in state legislative races. So, but, you know, it's like if you're sitting at home and hoping to win get a home run at every at-bat, yeah, that didn't happen.
Right.
When they look back at it, the Democrats are in a much better position today than they were yesterday or the day before.
But couldn't you say, Steve, that there's reasons to be optimistic about what happened yesterday, no matter which party you're a member of? There was some not good, but there was some very good.
You mean either party could make an argument for a big day?
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose so. I think the Democrats have a better case. I mean, the Republicans picked up a few seats in the Senate, and so that's good. Their majority is a little bigger for them there. They were expected to, at least, or, you know, it's not a surprise, I guess.
Sure.
But, you know, it's tough for the Republicans. They look at Scott Walker. Scott Walker was considered such a rising star in the Republican Party, and mm-hmm. he's going to lose in Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
There are a number of Midwest states that voted in Democratic governors. So, yeah, but you could make the case, sure, we picked up seats in the Senate, so that's good.
Yeah. Yep.
And we are scheduled to hear from President Donald Trump soon, I believe. So we'll take a quick break. We'll do some news. And it's Bill Leff, Wendy Snyder, 720 WGN.
Well, he went down to dinner in his Sunday best. Excitable boy, they all said.
He is an excitable boy. He is Vice President of Mortgage Lending at Pearl Mortgage. He's David Hochberg.
He's David Hochberg, Wendy. David, before we talk about business, can I ask you this? I know what a huge hockey fan you are. I know what a huge Blackhawks fan you are.
Yes.
A very strange day yesterday with the dismissal of Joel Quenneville, but you know a little something about the man who's succeeding him.
Yes, I was the official unofficial Ice Hog broadcaster for the Steve Cochran Show yesterday during their play last year during the playoff run.
Yeah, I remember that.
I went up to with Rockford, saw a couple of games, and I think the coach is a very talented individual. Right,
yeah.
Everybody was questioning Joel Quenneville when he came in, like who the hell's
right?
You know this guy, and he won us three cups in 10 years. Hate to see Q go. Loved him. Was great for the city. Was great for the team.
Right.
But you know what? Listen, you got 22 players on the ice. And one coach, or three coaches. All three of them got blown out. So if the 22 guys on the ice and the 25 guys on the roster aren't performing up to what management wants, guess what? It's a lot easier to blow out one or three instead of all 22. You know, I'm not going to get into, did they give them the players? Was there a power struggle? It's not my place to do that. I'm just saying that when the players on the ice are not performing up to the level that management expects them to perform,
something has to
give. You've got to make a decision, right or wrong, if you agree or disagree. It's easier to fire one coach or three coaches like they did. instead of firing the entire team. I hope this lights a fire under their ass and they start playing better, because as a season ticket holder and a suite holder for the next 3.5 years, I want to see good hockey. I want to see championships.
I also kept thinking yesterday, this has got to be very difficult for the guys letting Joel know that their tenure together is coming to an end.
Sure.
They loved him. That's hard. That's sure. a tough move.
But
tough move.
I believe John McDonough said yesterday, and I'm paraphrasing, he was a great man, tough decision, but we have to win games.
That's what Rocky said. You know, we have to make personnel decisions and management decisions, and if you don't want to make them, you got to make them.
Right.
You know, I don't know if you've ever had to lay somebody off. I've had to lay people off. It sucks.
I'd be a very bad business owner because I would never fire anybody and my business would go down the tubes.
It's not a very comfortable situation, but you have to make a decision that's best for the entire organization, as I said, and they felt that this move, if we agree with it or disagree with it, we'll find out in short enough time. I think we got to give the new coach and the team under his leadership all of our support and see where it takes us.
Will this change in coaches affect interest rates, David?
It actually, interest rates are flat, not right now.
Yeah,
okay, it could in the future.
I bet down the road it will.
And if it goes down, you could thank the Bowmans and you could thank Mr. Wirtz and Mr. McDonough and all the Blackhawk hierarchy organization for the lower rates. And if it doesn't, it's we'll blame somebody else. We'll blame Bruce Rauner.
All right, fair enough.
He's easy to blame.
Right. We are awaiting a speech from President Trump. Steve Bertrand will keep us posted on that.
A news conference, so he'll take some questions.
Yes.
Sure.
All right. In the meantime, let's fit in some mortgage talk. What do you want to cover today?
Well, here's what I want to cover. I want to cover tales of two borrowers. One borrower that's using their entire asset base to solve a problem, solve their mortgage challenge, and another borrower who refuses to use their entire asset base and everything in their arsenal to solve their mortgage challenge and
Who's
their
happier?
Debt challenge. Well, it's going to be the couple making $360,000 a year with $780,000 worth of mortgages, with $86,000 worth of debt, $81,000 worth of student loan debt. And what they're going to do is, and I talked to the guy on the way down. He's been a client of mine for 15 years. And I said, here's the deal. I said, we have to use, do you have a 401k and does your wife have a 401k? They're like, yes. I'm like, we need to tap into your 401k for as much as humanly possible, because your wife's a 740 and you're a 680. When you do a jumbo type of loan, that 60 points is a huge difference in the interest rate. So I explained to him. In my David Hochberg-esque way, as you've experienced.
Calm, cool, and collected.
Calm, cool, and collective. A couple of, you know, analogies. And I said, here's what we got to do. We got to tap out everything we could tap out. The cheapest money is your 401k. If you're willing to do that, we'll use that money to pay your loan down to 80% loan to value. We'll pay off whatever, we'll use whatever left over from your 401k on a loan. They're going to pay themselves back to pay down their debt.
Yes.
And by doing all this stuff and rearranging their financial furniture that way, within 2 years, their debt will be paid off. They'll be saving over $3,000 a month, okay, which is a lot of money.
It is a lot of money.
Okay, we have another couple over here who absolutely, they have one loan, a first loan, a second loan, and $76,000 worth of student loan debt, and they don't have enough equity in their home to roll everything together. So we went to them and said, here's your option. You have a 401k? Absolutely. We're about $40,000, $50,000 short, and they have like $500,000, $600,000 in the 401k, so they could easily borrow $50,000.
They're not taking all of it.
Right, right. And they're like, we refuse to touch our 401k. I said, then you'll continue to be in your financial crisis. Congratulations.
Mm-hmm.
That's fine. I mean,
decision.
There's no other way to rearrange everything we need to rearrange. That's the cheapest money that we could get to do what we need to do, or you're not going to be able to refinance. And they refuse to do it over here. One couple B doesn't want to do it. Couple A is all in. Guess what? We're going to help couple A within 2 years save $3,000 a month, and couple B will continue on their path and do whatever they want to do. You got to make that decision for yourself and your family. My whole goal is right now is to educate your listeners. If you borrow against the 401k and you pay yourself back, you're taking a loan out against your own assets, and you're reducing your debt.
Mm-hmm. So you are paying yourself back.
You're paying yourself back. You're not taking a disbursement. You're taking a loan against a 401k, and that's the cheapest money that this couple will be able to borrow. Okay, they've got $81,000 worth of student loan debt. They got $86,000 worth of credit card debt. Everybody's like, thinks I'm crazy when I come on here and say the average listener is carrying between $20,000 and $40,000 worth of credit card debt. This couple here is at $86,000 worth of credit card debt.
That's a lot of money.
Do couple A and couple B know each other, David?
No, not at all. I wish they did. Then couple A would talk sense into couple B.
Exactly.
Okay? But here's the thing: David will present you with your options, and it is rearranging your financial furniture.
It really, truly is,
and a lot of us don't know about that until we see it. And then you sit down, you look at it, you discuss it, and if you don't want to do it, That's up to you.
It's up
but
to you.
Why wouldn't you save money and help yourself get out of the hole?
This couple A, has a home equity line of credit that they took out 3 years ago that I helped them take out.
Yeah.
Okay, sent it to a bank. $388,000. He was starting a business. He needed some capital liquidity to make it through, whatever. He's in full stride now, all right? His company's up and running. His wife's got a solid job. Everything's going. He's experienced 7 rate increases over the past year and a half, 2 years, because the home equity line of credit, the short-term interest rate. Yeah, Wendy's shaking her head.
Yeah,
because
I get the notices.
Right.
We've raised it another quarter point.
Every quarter of a point on 388 Gs is $1,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
His home equity line of credit payment has gone up over $7,000 a year. That's a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So what he wants to do is he wants to take his first loan, his home equity line of credit, 388, that keeps increasing, put it into one big loan that doesn't increase, and seek some safe harbor until who knows when interest rates come down again, because we've had a little run here.
Are they ever going to come down?
Oh, sure. They always go, listen, what comes up comes down, right? A dead cat bounces, and all you cat lovers, that's just a saying. I love cats. Okay? But... You know. So, I'm just, you know, who thought 9/11 was going to happen, right?
We
have a terrorist attack. God forbid, the economy collapses, the rates collapsed, right? Rates started running up. We had another setback and went back down. We had the bank challenge that we had. So they lowered interest rates again.
And you're blaming all this on cats, David?
I'm blaming. Well, it's actually Bruce Rauner's fault. Rauner's fault.
Right.
Yeah. And cats.
Cats too.
Yes. So
we must take a break.
Okay.
Do you want a sponge?
I'm okay. I'm doing my Kegel exercise.
More with David Hochberg and his love of cats coming up right after this.
We'll be hearing from President Donald Trump in probably about a minute. David Hochberg here, Vice President of Mortgage Lending at Pearl Mortgage, P-E-R-L. How do people get in touch with you?
Very simple. You go to WGNDavid.com, WGNDAVID.com, or you could call us 24 hours a day, 7 days a week to talk about your refinancing options and home buying options at 312-751-1333, 312-751-1333. Thank you for squeezing me in front of the president. It was very nice.
Of course.
Nice warm-up for Donald Trump.
Yeah, well, you know, so I've been accused of warming people up before, so I'm glad I was able to warm up your listeners for about ready what they're about to hear. So thank you.
Thank you. Rearranging the financial furniture.
Have a great day.
Thank you very much. That's David Hochberg.
The excitable boy.
Absolutely. We are going to go to the newsroom. Steve Bertrand is monitoring Donald Trump
right
now.
President Trump is going to hold a news conference here. It looks like he's in the East Room of the White House. And this day after the midterm elections, the headline certainly from the midterm is the fact that the control of the U.S. House has switched from Republican to the Democrats, but for the Republicans, they picked up a couple of seats in the Senate, maybe more, flipped a couple, where there are still a few that have been declared too close to call, but certainly things went the Republicans' way on that chamber, and that was the area that the president focused on more once it was clear that it looked like the House was going to go Democratic. So we're expecting Bill and Wendy to hear from the president, and he will take some questions about this. Nancy Pelosi will speak after the President Trump does, at least that's the plan, at the U.S. Capitol, and we hope to bring those remarks to you as well.
Thank you, Steve. Greatly appreciated.
I'm looking forward to see what he has to say.
Well, I'm just guessing here, but it's very Trumpian of him to claim victory. So
I think that's true, Bill.
Yeah.
And like I said earlier, you know, the Republicans lost a number of governor seats, one here in Illinois. So it was a big night for the Democrats on that front as well.
Yeah. The relationship between Ted Cruz and President Trump has been bumpy. And I say that in very big, thick letters.
Are people surprised Ted Cruz made it last night?
No. I mean, you know.
A Democrat to come that close to winning, Steve, that's the story in Texas,
Democrats,
right?
Democrats fall in love with, an impossible candidate every once in a while. And this cycle was Beto O'Rourke's. I mean, he certainly did well. And I think, Bill, there's arguments that he helped candidates for Congress below him with the great enthusiasm.
Right.
And looked for a time last night like he might pull it off. But
it was
Texas
inevitable.
Is just a very, very red state.
And, yeah.
You know, and Ted Cruz is not popular among his fellow Republican senators, even. He's not a liked guy. But it's tough for an incumbent Republican to lose in a state like Texas.
You know, Rachel Maddow, I watched her a little bit last night, and she said something very interesting about Ted Cruz. She said that in a business where people need to be liked, he almost embraces the fact that he's not liked. What he rides in on is the fact that he's not looking to make friends. He knows people don't like him. He's fine with that. Can that be true?
Maybe. There was another guy who was quoting a senator. He didn't name the senator, but he said that the senator told him, he goes, I like Ted Cruz more than my fellow senators. He goes, I hate him.
Wow. But to her point, politics is one guy scratching the other guy's back and then the other guy helping him back out. So when you separate yourself the way Ted Cruz does and just says, yeah, people don't like me, I don't like them, whatever, that's strange for business, isn't it?
Yeah, but Cruz does some of that too. I mean, look, the president accused his father of being involved in the assassination.
I know.
Called his wife ugly.
Yeah.
And then he's inviting him down to Texas to campaign with him.
Right.
So he's certainly shown an ability to do that. This is a very unconventional presidency and White House. And today's latest evidence of that is that they gave us a 2-minute warning about 7 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So that's why you guys came to me. Typically, when they give a 2-minute warning at an event like this, it's pretty firm.
Right. Right.
Look like there's any movement soon. Can we squeeze in a commercial break?
It's impossible to say, Wendy.
Okay.
I don't know.
Right.
All right, well, why don't we tell you about Tree Time? We can do that, and you can interrupt us if necessary.
All right, Tree Time in Lake Barrington, Wendy, has Chicagoland's largest selection of the most realistic artificial Christmas trees and Christmas decorations, all at factory direct prices. There's over 200 styles of artificial Christmas trees in their Wonderland showroom.
You won't believe the selection, the quality, all created by top designers for great style, lifelike beauty, and craftsmanship to last for years to come. Plus, you're going to find more lights, ornaments, wreaths, and unique decorations than you can ever imagine. And join Tree Time top designer Cassie Nicholas for a free decorating class on how to create a stunning holiday mantle this season at Tree Time. It's happening this Saturday, November 10th at 2 p.m.
Tree Time even has a man cave for dads, hot chocolate and cookies provided for the kids at Chicagoland's largest selection of the most artificial, realistic artificial Christmas trees and Christmas decorations, all at factory direct prices. But there's limited quantities and they do sell out. They sell out fast. So stop in now for the best selection. That's Tree Time right there on Pepper Road off Northwest Highway 14 in Lake Barrington. You can also visit treetime.com.
Everything Christmas, treetime.com.
All right. The 2-minute warning has now turned into a 9-minute warning.
Right. Right. I'm sure there's a lot of last-minute jockeying in what's going to be said and how it's going to be said. So
Steve Bertrand doing a great job in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom, and we will find out all about that.
Can I ask Steve a quick question? Steve, you weren't around yesterday for the election coverage that went on through the night, right? You weren't in on any of that, were you?
No, I was home. I was home listening and watching.
A great job yesterday, mostly by Justin Kaufman, but everybody who participated, it really was a very interesting evening.
Kaufman knows what he's doing, doesn't
he? Sure does.
He really does.
Yeah. And our own Eric Zorn sat in on one of the panels. He kept rotating panels. Everybody did a good job. It was really it was fun to listen. I kept going back and forth between TV coverage and our coverage here.
Yeah, I
love election night, so.
Yeah, you said yesterday as you were leaving, I can't wait to get home. And I said, why? Because no political ads.
Right. Like, no, just the opposite.
But watch TV now and see how easygoing and simple and fun it is again. Because it really, it got you so worked up the last couple of weeks watching hate ad after hate ad after hate ad. And now those ads are gone, thankfully.
Do we have a president close to a podium? Because if not, I'm going to slip in this commercial break.
Go for it.
All right. You're right here. No need to go anywhere else. 720 WGN. All right. We go live to the newsroom and Steve Bertrand, WGN Chicago.
The president just introduced taking the podium at the White House, where he's expected to take questions about yesterday's midterm election. The Democrats taking control of the House.
Big day yesterday. An incredible day. And last night, the Republican Party defied history to expand our Senate majority while significantly beating expectations in the House for the midterm and midterm year. We did this in spite of a very dramatic fundraising disadvantage driven by Democrats' wealthy donors and special interests and a very hostile media coverage, to put it mildly. The media coverage set a new record and a new standard. We also had a staggering number of House retirements, so it's a little tough. These are seats that could have been held pretty easily, and we had newcomers going in, and a lot of them worked very hard, but it's very difficult when you have that many retirements. We held a large number of campaign rallies with large numbers of people going to everyone. To the best of my knowledge, we didn't have a vacant or an empty seat. I'm sure you would have reported it if you spotted one, including 30 rallies in the last 60 days. And we saw the candidates that I supported achieve tremendous success last night. As an example of the 11 candidates we campaigned with during the last week, 9 won last night. This vigorous campaigning stopped the blue wave that they talked about. I don't know if there ever was such a thing, but could have been. If we didn't do the campaigning, probably there could have been. And the history really will see what a good job we did in the final couple of weeks in terms of getting some tremendous people over the finish line. They really are tremendous people, but many of them were not known. But they will be known. This election marks the largest Senate gains for a president's party in a first midterm election since at least President Kennedy's in 1962. There have been only 4 midterm elections since 1934 in which a president's party has gained even a single Senate seat. As of now, we picked up, it looks like 3. Could be 4. Perhaps it could be 2. But we picked up a lot. And most likely the number will be 3. You people probably know that better than I do at this point because you've looked at the more recent numbers. 55 is the largest number of Republican senators in the last 100 years. In the last 80 years, a sitting president's party has only gained a cumulative total of 8 Senate seats, averaging 1 per decade. So if we picked up 2, 3, or 4, that's a big percentage of that number. So in the last 80 years, you think of that, only 8 seats. In President Obama's first midterm election, he lost 6 Senate seats, including in the deep blue state of Massachusetts. Republicans captured at least 4 Senate seats held by Democrat incumbents. And these are tremendously talented, hardworking people that did this. Indiana, North Dakota, Florida, Missouri. We also won 2 open Senate seats in Tennessee. I want to congratulate our great champion who did such a great job in Tennessee, Marcia, and in Utah. And Arizona is looking very good, really very good. She's done a terrific job. That was a tough race, and she's done a fantastic job. In each of these open seats, Democrats recruited very strong candidates with substantial fundraising and media support. We were getting bombarded with money on the other side. In the House, Republicans dramatically outperformed historical precedents and overcame a historic number of retirements, the most House Republican retirements in 88 years, 43 House Republicans retired. Now, I will say this, that in many cases they were chairmen of committees, and they left because they weren't chairmen, because the Republicans have a rule for 6 years. And what that does is wonderful in one way. It lets people come through the system and become chairman. In another way, it drives people out. Because when they're a chairman, they don't want to go and not be a chairman. You're the chairman of a committee, and you're a big deal, and all of a sudden, you're not doing that anymore. So they leave. We had a lot of them leave. It's, I guess you can flip a coin as to which system is better. The Democrats do the other. Some of their folks have been on those committees for a long time as chairman. In 2010, President Obama's first midterm, he lost 63 seats. By contrast, as of the most current count, looks like around 27 House seats or something. and we'll figure that out pretty soon. We also had a slew of historic wins in the governor's races. The governor's races were incredible. Against very well-funded, talented, and skilled Democrat candidates and people that worked very, very hard, respectfully, for those candidates, like Oprah Winfrey, who I like. I don't know if she likes me anymore, but that's okay. She used to. But she worked very hard in Georgia, very, very hard. And the presidential race, Florida, Iowa, Ohio, and Georgia, the big ones. Florida, Iowa, Ohio, and Georgia. Can't get much more important than that. They were incredible. They were actually incredible campaigns, too. Incredible. As of right now, Republicans will control the majority of governorships across the country, including three great women who worked very hard, governors of Alabama, South Dakota, and Iowa. They worked very, very hard. They're very talented. By expanding our Senate majority, the voters have also clearly rebuked the Senate Democrats for their handling of the Kavanaugh hearings. That was a factor, I think maybe a very big factor. The way that was handled, I think, was tremendous energy was given to the Republican Party by the way they treated then-Judge Kavanaugh, now Justice Kavanaugh, and expressed their support for confirming more great pro-Constitution judges. Candidates who embraced our message of low taxes, low regulations, low crime, strong borders, and great judges excelled last night. They excelled. They really, I mean, we have a list of people that were fantastic. And I'm just going to point them out. Mike Bost, Rodney Davis, Andy Barr was fantastic. I went to Kentucky. For the most part, I didn't campaign for the House, but I did actually make a special trip for Andy Barr because he was in a very tough race in Kentucky, and he won. That was a very tough race. The polls were all showing that he was down and down substantially, and he won. And that one I did do. Pete Stauber of Minnesota, great guy. He's new. And ran a fantastic race. On the other hand, you had some that decided to, let's stay away. Let's stay away. They did very poorly. I'm not sure that I should be happy or sad, but I feel just fine about it. Carlos Cubella. Mike Kaufman. Too bad, Mike. Mia Love. I saw Mia Love. She'd call me all the time to help her with a hostage situation, being held hostage in Venezuela. But Mia Love gave me no love, and she lost. Too bad. Sorry about that, Mia. And Barbara Comstock was another one. I mean, I think she could have won that race, but she didn't want to have any embrace. For that, I don't blame her. But she lost, substantially lost. Peter Roskam didn't want the embrace. Eric Paulson didn't want the embrace. And in New Jersey, I think he could have done well, but didn't work out too good. Bob Eugen, I feel badly because I think that's something that could have been won. That's a race that could have been won. John Faso, those are some of the people that, you know, decided for their own reason not to embrace whether it's me or what we stand for, but what we stand for meant a lot to most people. And we've had tremendous support and tremendous support in the Republican Party, among the biggest support in the history of the party. I've actually heard at 93%, it's a record, but I won't say that because who knows. But we've had tremendous support. America is booming like never before, doing fantastic. We have Larry Kudlow here, and he said the numbers are as good as he's ever seen numbers at any time for our country, but he's a young man, so he hasn't seen that many numbers. Where's Larry? You're a young man, right, Larry? And you haven't been doing this too long, but they're as good as you've ever seen. And we may have, if you have a question for Larry, we'll do that. But I want to send my warmest appreciation and regards to Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. We really worked very well together. We have been working very well together. We actually have a great relationship. People just don't understand that, which is fine. And also to perhaps, looks like, I would think, Speaker Nancy Pelosi. And I give her a lot of credit. She works very hard, and she's worked long and hard. I give her a great deal of credit for what she's done and what she's accomplished. Hopefully, we can all work together next year to continue delivering for the American people, including on economic growth, infrastructure, trade, lowering the cost of prescription drugs. These are some of the things that the Democrats do want to work on, and I really believe we'll be able to do that. I think we're going to have a lot of reason to do it. And I will say, just as a matter of business, I was with some very successful people last night. We were watching the returns. So if the Republicans won, and let's say we held on by two, or one, or three, it would have been very hard out of that many Republicans to ever even get support among Republicans, because there'll always be one or two or three people that, for good reason or for bad reason or for grandstanding, we have that too. You've seen that. You've seen that. Plenty of grandstanding. But for certain reasons, that many people, you're always going to have a couple that won't do it. So that puts us in a very bad position. In other words, had we kept, and this is no, I'm saying this for a very basic reason, it's common sense. It puts us in a very tough position. We win by one or two or three, and you'll have one or two or three or four or five even come over and say, you know, look, we're not going to go along with this. We want this, 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 and all of a sudden we wouldn't even be able to get it in many cases out of the Republicans' hands before we sent it on to the Senate. And now we have a much easier path, because the Democrats will come to us with a plan for infrastructure, a plan for health care, a plan for whatever they are looking at, and we'll negotiate. And as you know, it's been very hard in the Senate because we need essentially 10 votes from Democrats, and we don't get those votes because the Democrats do really stick together well. I don't agree with them on a lot of policy, but I agree with them on sticking together. They stick together great. So now we go into the Senate. We don't have the 10 votes. And what happens? It doesn't get passed. Even if it gets out of the House, it doesn't get passed. So under the new concept of what we're doing, I say, come on, let me see what you have. They want to do things. You know, I keep hearing about investigations, fatigue. Like from the time, almost from the time I announced I was going to run, they've been giving us this investigation fatigue. It's been a long time. They got nothing. Zero. You know why? Because there is nothing. But they can play that game, but we can play it better. Because we have a thing called the United States Senate. And a lot of very questionable things were done between leaks of classified information and many other elements that should not have taken place. And all you're going to do is end up in back and forth and back and forth, and 2 years is going to go up, and we won't have done a thing. I really think, and I really respected what Nancy said last night about bipartisanship and getting together and uniting. She used the word uniting, and she used the bipartisanship statement, which is so important because that's what we should be doing. So we can look at us, they can look at us, and then we can look at them, and it'll go back and forth, and it'll probably be very good for me politically. I could see it being extremely good politically, because I think I'm better at that game than they are, actually. But we'll find out. I mean, you know, we'll find out. Or we can work together. You can't do them simultaneously, by the way, just in case somebody says, oh, you can do them both. No, you can't. Because if they're doing that, we're not doing the other, just so you understand. So we won't be doing that. But now what happens is we send it to the Senate, And we'll get 100% Democrat support, and we'll get some Republican support. And if it's good, I really believe we have Republicans that will help with the approval process, and they will really help with the approval process. So it really could be a beautiful bipartisan type of situation. If we won by one or two or three or four or five, that wouldn't happen. And the closer it is, the worse it is. This way, they'll come to me, we'll negotiate, maybe we'll make a deal, maybe we won't. That's possible. But we have a lot of things in common on infrastructure. We want to do something on health care. They want to do something on health care. There are a lot of great things that we can do together. And now we'll send it up, and we will really get, we'll get the Democrats, and we'll get the Republicans or some of the Republicans. And I'll make sure that we send something up that the Republicans can support. And they're going to want to make sure they send something up that the Democrats can support. So our great country is booming like never before, and we're thriving on every single level, both in terms of economic and military strength, in terms of development, in terms of GDP, we're doing unbelievably. I will tell you, our trade deals are coming along fantastically. The USMCA and South Korea is finished. USMCA has gotten rave reviews. We're not going to lose companies anymore to other countries. They're not going to do that because they have a tremendous economic incentive. It's meaning it's prohibitive for them to do that. So it's not going to be like NAFTA, which is one of the worst deals I've ever seen, although we've made some other pretty bad ones too. Now is the time for members of both parties to join together, put partisanship aside, and keep the American economic miracle going strong. It is a miracle. We're doing so well. And I've said it at a lot of rallies. Some of you have probably heard it so much you don't want to hear it again. But when people come to my office, presidents, prime ministers, they all congratulate me almost the first thing on what we've done economically. Because it is really amazing. And our steel industry is back. Our aluminum industry is starting to do really well. These are industries that were dead. Our miners are working again. We must all work together to protect our military. We have to do that. To support our law enforcement, secure our borders, and advance really great policy, including environmental policy. We want crystal clean water. We want beautiful, perfect air. Air and water has to be perfect. At the same time, we don't want to put ourselves at a disadvantage to other countries who are very competitive with us and who don't abide by the rules at all. We don't want to hurt our jobs. We don't want to hurt our factories. We don't want companies leaving. We want to be totally competitive, and we are. And right now we have just about the cleanest air, the cleanest water we've ever had, and it's always going to be that way. We insist on it. So environmental is very important to me. And with that, I'll take a few questions if you'd like. Whoa. I didn't know what happened. All right. Go ahead, John. That was a lot of hand shooting up so quickly. There's a lot to talk about.
Mr. President, you talked at length just now about bipartisanship. The presumed Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, talked about it last night. I'm sure that's encouraging for the American people. But do you really believe, given what the relationship has been like between this White House and the Democratic Party, that that will happen?
I think there's a good chance. I think there's a very good chance.
If I could just finish
it, will happen.
Will you have to compromise on certain issues to the point where it could hurt you in 2020? And do you expect that when the Democrats take over the chairmanship of all these important committees, you're going to get hit with a blizzard of subpoenas on everything from the Russia investigation to your cell phone use to your tax returns?
Ready? Then you're going to... If that happens, then we're going to do the same thing, and government comes to a halt. And I would blame them, because they now are going to be coming up with policy. They're the majority in the House. I expect that they will come up with some fantastic ideas that I can support on the environment, on so many different things, including prescription drug prices, which we've made a big dent in already, including some of the things that we're working on for the vets. We've gotten choice approved. We've got a lot of things approved, but they have some other elements that we want. There are many things we can get along on without a lot of trouble that we agree very much with them and they agree with us. I would like to see bipartisanship. I'd like to see unity. And I think we have a very good chance of, and maybe not on everything, but I think we have a very good chance of seeing that. Go ahead.
One question on the lame duck, sir, and one on your cabinet. You toyed with the idea during the campaign of a shutdown before the midterms in order to secure border wall funding. Are you prepared to go on a shutdown strategy during the lame duck, since this might be your last best chance?
Not necessarily.
To secure that?
Look, I speak to Democrats all the time. They agree that a wall is necessary. Wall is necessary. And as you know, we're building the wall. We've started, but we should build it at one time, not in chunks.
But you want much more money, and you want much sooner.
No, we need the money to build the wall, the whole wall, not pieces of it all over. And we are doing it. Now we have the military. Now we have other elements of a wall that are pretty nasty, to be honest with you. But it's nevertheless, it's pretty hard to get through it. But no, I'd like to see the wall. Many of the people that we'll be dealing with, you know, in 2006, they approved the wall, essentially. It was a very strong border fence, but it was the same thing. And they all approved it. They all agreed. I have statements from every one of them. We have them saying we need the wall. I mean, they sound like me. Mm-hmm. But we do need it. Because
you have been listening to President Donald Trump on the post-election defeat in the House and the win in the Senate. As expected, the president focused on that Senate win, saying that the Republicans defied history last night by gaining seats in the Senate. He also mentioned that he did not see the shellacking that President Obama saw in 2010. He blamed the loss in the House on the record number of Republicans retiring from the House and deciding to leave. He also said he really didn't campaign for the House. He talked about Republicans who tried to distance themselves, even mentioning Peter Roskam by name. Tried to distance themselves from the president. He said they chose not to embrace him. He did also talk a little bit about the economy. He said it was booming, and he hopes that he will be able to work with the presumed Democratic House Speaker Nancy Pelosi when the Democrats do take over. We, of course, will continue to monitor the president's talking as we continue throughout the day. We also expect to hear
he'll be talking throughout the day, perhaps. Who knows?
we also plan to hear from Nancy Pelosi here soon, and we'll take some of her comments live as well.
Perfect. Eric Rung in the newsroom. We thank you so much for that. And we have a show that we're going to kind of intersperse throughout all these speeches today. Dr. John Duffy is coming up after the 11:30 news.
It's Bill Leff. It's Wendy Snyder. Right now we're in something of a holding pattern. President Trump is still talking to members of the press. Nancy Pelosi will speak shortly, and we will cover part of that as well.
Eric Rung is in the newsroom, the Northwestern Medicine newsroom. Do you have any idea when Nancy is supposed to come to the podium?
Well, it'll be after President Trump is done.
Any addressing. Idea when that's going to finish?
I mean, if I knew that, I wouldn't be sitting here. I'll tell you that much. I mean, a lot of these freewheeling press conferences, I mean, they could go for 90 minutes. They could go. I mean, I've covered them where they've gone 90 minutes.
President Trump just walked away
just
from the
that.
Podium, which looked like he was leaving, but I think he was just taking a pause and then moved back to the podium.
Well, I think he was talking with Jim Acosta from CNN, who they have had a bitter
stormy relationship.
To say the least.
Yep.
And I was listening in. He was Jim Acosta was really kind of peppering President Trump with a number of questions, and
that's why he walked away.
And I think he just got up again here.
Eric, the president addressed something that a lot of us had on our minds over the last couple of weeks, and that is whether or not Oprah Winfrey does in fact like President Trump. He took a couple of minutes there to give his dissertation on
why do I believe everything you say.
No, he did.
He did talk about it.
He really did.
He said that she had been campaigning for Stacey Abrams in Georgia and had been campaigning hard for her, and she lost. And he brought that up, saying that Oprah doesn't have possibly the power that a lot of people think she does.
She's got favorite things.
She does have favorite things. And he did say that he likes Oprah, and that there was a time that Oprah liked him. But then he kind of went back and forth as to whether or not Oprah still likes him or not. And that needed to be said, Wendy. That was a very important moment in today's press conference.
You know what frightens me is I am very similar to Donald Trump in that respect. You know I hate when I find out somebody doesn't like
me. Right,
and I will do whatever possible to make them like me.
Eric, do we know if Kelly and Ryan like the president right now? That's very important. That's a question I think a lot of us...
I have one source on that right now.
What are you hearing?
I'm waiting for another source. I don't feel as if I should be reporting that just
right
now.
All right, that's fair. All right.
All right, now Eric Rung is in the newsroom. This is going to be tough for him because we are going to throw it to news, yet he is also monitoring President Donald Trump, who's speaking. He's going to tell us when Nancy Pelosi will hit the podium. And we have our show psychologist, Dr. John Duffy, who was scheduled at 11. We moved until 11:30, and that might be right about the time Nancy Pelosi starts talking.
In the event of that, Dr. Duffy has been kind enough to he'll slide over into the bonus hour, the stream of consciousness with us. So that'll be fun.
Does he know what happens during the bonus hour?
I don't know that he does.
Because what happens during the bonus hour stays in the bonus hour.
That's best for everybody.
I like to call it Bill Leff Unleashed.
Oh, it's dangerous in the bonus hour.
It is.
So we'll figure something out.
Eric, thank you very much. Any word on when Nancy Pelosi is going to speak to the nation?
Not yet. Still waiting. As I mentioned, what we have kind of been told a little bit is that she will speak after the president, and who knows how long President Trump is going to continue to take questions. It doesn't look like he's going to be slowing down.
All right, then we
can
actually get our scheduled guest in, which is clinical psychologist, certified life coach, parenting and relationship expert, all around nice guy, Dr. John Duffy. How are you, Dr. Duffy?
I'm great, guys. How are you?
It was weird having you in here watching the president speak. You know, it's like we were just three of us looking at the TV screen and listening to things.
Yeah, it was.
What do you make of this?
Well, okay, so
not to put you on the spot.
Right, I'm fascinated watching the president speak because he can riff, and I'm watching him now riffing on and on and on. And there's something in my field called neuro-linguistic programming, which is kind of the science of precise language. And what our president is very deft at, whether you are a fan or not, is imprecise language and dodging an issue and creating another argument or situation to focus on that has nothing to do with what he's supposed to be addressing or being asked about.
Is that a diversionary tactic?
It's a brilliant diversionary tactic. It's probably, to my thinking, the skill he possesses most, is that ability to recognize, okay, I have this base. They want to hear certain things from me. So regardless of what I'm asked, I'm going to guide my comments toward this thing. So instead of precisely answering a question, and we can think of other presidents who will reiterate a question before they answer it. They're so keyed in on, oh, I want to be precise. I want to be exact. I want to make sure I address what you're asking me. This president is not that interested in that.
He's the essay question president.
Well, I always say this. Remember when you were in fourth grade and the question on the test is, what is the Magna Carta? And you don't know what it is. So you say, the Magna Carta was important for many varied reasons.
Right.
Some of them important, some not. And you just talk and talk and talk. And by the end, the teacher's like, whatever.
Right. Come the Magna on. And the Carta, both relevant.
Right, together, working together. But he does that on an almost daily basis. Today, during this press conference, he was answering a question about some chairmen that are no longer involved because they were voted out.
Right.
And he talked about what a chairman's role is. When a group gets together, they have to have a chairman to be a... We all know that.
Right. So in a way, I think what he's doing there is just filling space. This is an old speaking tactic too, and you guys have been speakers for public orators for a very long time, and every once in a while you find yourself maybe having to fill a moment, right?
Yeah, sure.
For Trump, I think he has to fill a lot of moments with kind of the obvious, in order to find the next thread, because I think he's eluding questions oftentimes, and that takes a little brain trickery.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I feel like I'm just watching this on TV and it's not happening in real life. That's what I'm just pretending.
Well, he just took a couple of minutes. He's going through a list of politicians that were voted out yesterday. And on the ones he didn't like, he would say things like too bad or bye bye or gone, you know, that kind of thing. No other president's ever done. You should have said that. He should have gone back to that.
No kidding.
But I don't remember any other president upon doing this, you know, the day after the election saying, well, they didn't agree with me. Now they're gone. Too bad. Bye-bye.
I remember years ago, I think it may have been Conan O'Brien who called Bill Clinton the Teflon president for being able to bounce back from any scandal.
Yeah.
I think he misunderstood how Teflon a president can be, because so many presidents since then, including Clinton, have felt like they had to be orators, really specific in what they have to say and clear about what their agendas are and who they support. This president isn't beholden to that. I don't think the people who support him require that of him. I think the brashness and the willingness to look beyond the question to what I feel like talking about, I think that's where the appeal is for an awful lot of people who are drawn to him.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Dr. John Duffy is with us. He's a clinical psychiatrist, psychologist. He does a podcast with his wife, Julie Duffy, called Better. You can find it wherever your favorite podcasts are found. And you are going to be on the air tonight at 11 p.m.
Yes, I am hosting Nightside tonight from 11 to 1 with Paul, and I always get Paul's last name wrong, so I'm going to work hard here, Paul Farivar. Who is on with Patty a lot, and he is a lawyer. He is a single man to my married man, so we're going to have some contrast. We're going to talk relationships tonight, so it should be really fun.
Fun, good.
And that's 11 p.m.
And a very
PM
funny guy.
Does
to
he
1
spell it like the former quarterback of the Green Bay Packers? Is it spelled that way? Or different?
He uses bits and pieces, and then he's added a few things.
Put more letters. Oh, good. That's excellent.
All right, and we will talk about marijuana with you when we come back.
Correct, yes.
Up until Nancy Pelosi speaks. All right, it's Bill F., it's Wendy Snyder at 720 WGN. Jeez, I got so many things going through my head. We're awaiting Nancy Pelosi. I'm done.
No, you're fine.
I said it twice. Pelosi will be speaking to us. Eric Rung is monitoring that. In the meantime, so marijuana, I saw today that it was approved for or will be approved, or the people voted that they want it to be a recreational drug in Michigan.
Correct.
So,
correct.
Marijuana, I kind of tend to think when you're an adult and you smoke marijuana, you may have less issues than people who abuse alcohol. But again, I guess abuse is the bad word in there.
Correct. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword, because young people are very deft at the argument because they do really good research, and it doesn't take much of a Google search to come up with an argument that, well, hey, marijuana is far less lethal than alcohol. People aren't dying marijuana deaths. People aren't, you know, dying from car crashes that are pot related. And so there is this kind of burgeoning argument, especially as it becomes more and more legal. And I think, you know, the sweep of history will make it legal in all 50 states and in pretty soon.
Yeah.
A lot of the young people I work with feel like there is very little difficulties, very little problem that falls as a direct result of marijuana use. And I think that on the whole, they're right. It's not going to kill them like many other drugs will. The caution I always give to parents and the kids is, there are a couple problems that I have with it. First of all, nothing drains motivation more readily than regular pot use.
Sure.
It's impressive.
Not even alcohol use?
You know, kids use alcohol differently. Kids use alcohol in a more like social, unless they have a real problem with it. They tend to use it on Thirsty Thursdays now.
And then
Fridays, right. And there's a Wednesday thing too, an acronym I can't remember.
Thirsty Thursdays.
Right. And Fridays and Saturdays. And but a lot of them are judicious about it. They designate drivers. So they would argue, hey, we're better than you guys were as far as alcohol goes.
And they don't do it during the week as much.
Exactly.
You're right. You're right.
And I think part of it is the vaping and juuling culture that's kind of showing up in their lives. It makes the jump, the gateway toward marijuana use, not that big a jump. It's actually pretty easy to go from, oh, I vape this stuff that tastes like, you know, cereal, to I smoke these Juul pods that just have nicotine in them, but don't have all the tar and all the carcinogens. And the Juul itself, in fairness, looks pretty cool. To, well, I can try this pot, you know, out of this thing. You know, that's not that big a deal. And suddenly you've got somebody who lacks motivation and is part of a culture of people who are kind and warm and welcoming. Seriously, right. Like, they're very nice people. But by and large, they're not raising the bar for each other. Yeah, and that's my concern.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Legitimate concern, I think.
Yeah.
I don't smoke pot.
Right.
I know a lot of people do. I have at times taken anti-anxiety medications. A lot of people, I think, Bill, you'd be surprised. A lot of people around us every day probably smoke every day. And
in the newsroom, you mean?
I didn't say that.
I thought you were going to say that.
But it's like, you know, when I'm kind of amazed when I go, oh, you're a pot smoker?
Right.
You wouldn't think it. A lot of people use that instead of maybe taking anxiety meds.
Definitely. People,
as an adult, though, I'm not for kids doing it.
Right. But kids do it. I mean, and sometimes they don't recognize. I think sometimes adults don't either. The degree to which they are smoking in a medicinal way. Right. Am I medicating anxiety to some extent? And for better or worse, there are some studies, overseas studies, because it's still a class A drug here in the States, so you can't do a whole lot of research on it. But overseas, there are some studies that suggest that in small doses, that some of the chemicals in marijuana have anti-anxiety elements to them. So there are a lot of people who smoke who I think are managing anxiety, especially if somebody smokes every day or several times a day.
Right.
I'm almost always asking them, what exactly are we medicating here?
Sure.
Because this is no longer a recreational thing for you. This is something you're taking.
It's a hobby.
You're dosing it, you know? Right. Yeah.
Couple of texts, 815. I love weed. This mom is stoked.
Oh.
Then you have No Way Dude. I smoke multiple times per day. I run an office, Daisy Scout Troop, and volunteer at my church. So no, dude, you are wrong. Not lacking motivation here.
Oh, can I speak to him?
Please.
So okay, I totally get what you're saying, because there is this subset of people that I find have so much juice and so much energy that they can smoke an awful lot. Frequently, almost every day, or maybe every day, like he's saying, or she.
I'm 55, says this person.
Yeah, and be able to function at a really, really high level. And the marijuana might bring them down, in fact, anxiety-wise, to a level where they function optimally. I really do think that happens. I would argue with the texter respectfully that you are not the norm. You are the exception.
Like the ADHD meds, a stimulant kind of chills you out. It depends how your body works with things.
Right.
So someone else, stop calling it pot. It's cannabis, Wendy. This isn't high school anymore.
I think probably either term is acceptable.
Weed.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and if you're
Mary
talking,
Jane.
Right. Well, it depends on what decade we're working in.
True. Right. And what's the, is it CBD oil?
Yes.
Somebody wanted to know about, is that the benefit of marijuana without the high?
Yeah. So there is research done on CBD oil here, and it does seem to have some pain management capacity.
I've used that in like a lotion for my knee, and it's I don't know why it works or how it works,
but it did.
They say it works like a counter irritant, like Icy Hot or something like that. Yeah, and people tell me it's really effective, and I've read a little bit about CBD oil, and I suspect we're going to be hearing more and more about that for
We've
sure.
We've used canola oil a few times, John. Is that still right?
Well, yeah, for some of your baking needs.
Yeah, we've used it for French bread a couple times. Absolutely. What about people? I've had this talk with Tim. We've had Tim Ryan on several times, many times over the years.
The Man in Recovery Foundation.
About, yeah.
Right.
All right. So for kids that want to do something that they're not supposed to do, a lot of them turn to the marijuana.
Yes.
once that's given to them, are they going to turn to something more potent and dangerous?
Is it a gateway drug? Is that what you're asking?
Wendy wants to know if it's a gateway drug.
Because I think alcohol is a gateway drug then, too.
I think alcohol is more of a gateway drug. And research suggests that the biggest gateway drug we have right now is nicotine.
Sure.
Not cannabis or Mary Jane or marijuana.
Yeah.
So in fairness to the marijuana smokers out there, the truth of the matter is when I work with somebody who smokes marijuana, that tends to be their drug of choice, and things tend not to evolve on a regular basis beyond that. There might be a club drug on occasion or something like that,
yeah.
But in terms of regular use, it tends to stop there. That's not a rule, but that's what I see more often than not by far.
And alcohol, I mean, bottom line, if you are impaired and one of your friends says, hey, do you want to try these pills? I think that's when kids... I just think about this now because when I was a kid, we didn't have pills that people offered, but I wouldn't have taken something I didn't know what it would have done. But mm-hmm. I guess I tried marijuana, so that's not a good comparison.
And the drug culture for kids now, there's so little taboo affiliated with so many different things, right? So some of the things that we use for ADHD, for example, your Adderalls, your Ritalins, there's a market in most high schools for these medications. It's usually about $5 a pill. And the taboo affiliated with selling these things is non-existent.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, it's really kind of like, well, I'm just helping my friends through a test. What's the big deal?
Yeah.
I do worry about the just the ease with which kids are willing to kind of take pills without really worrying about,
sure.
like, am I taking something that I really understand? Is this safe? They tend not to try things when somebody else isn't around, but that's not a rule either. You know, sometimes kids are willing to venture outside of that as well.
Yeah, I bet.
Yeah.
Another text, I have a 20-year-old who's a sophomore in college that fits the picture Dr. Duffy mentioned. My son was on Concerta for 10 years for ADD, quit taking it, smokes marijuana instead, but he frequently forgets things and is not motivated. He has a lot of anxiety still. So again, your mileage may vary.
Your mileage may vary. And if you find you suffer from anxiety, and anybody who smokes daily, I would encourage them to consider whether that's the case. My bias would be to sit down with a therapist or even a drug rehab specialist, and not that it requires massive rehab in every single circumstance, and just talk about, okay, is there a different way for me to manage this symptom than to smoke this drug all the time? Because because the texter does bring up an important issue that comes up with cannabis use frequently is memory problems. That this shows up as well.
Dude, where's my car?
Yeah.
I'm just asking you where my car is.
I'll help you find it.
Real quickly, more and more when I'm at a public event, I smell weed in the air. The smoke affects me much more than someone next to me who has a beer. Like, you do smell it at concerts now. I didn't before.
Right.
It's very prevalent in many places. If this becomes legal, that'll probably be the norm where you're going to smell it in the air a lot.
Oh, yeah, and it's far more potent than it used to be, too, and we can't ignore that.
It smells like skunk now.
Yeah. It does.
Again, years ago,
right.
when it was called pot,
right.
I liked the smell of that and coffee more than I liked the taste of either of them.
Right,
Wendy
right,
sometimes
right.
will go to a concert with a skunk, and people keep asking her for marijuana, and she doesn't have it. She just has a pet skunk.
Yeah. The skunk likes Zeppelin. Yeah. What can I say?
And finally, I was a lifelong drinker, now a recovering alcoholic, still smoke weed and have not had a drink in years. Smoking weed won't hurt you. Alcohol will kill you.
You know, that's a story that I've heard before. And first of all, you know, kudos to the texter for beating a very, very difficult addiction. And I do think there's something to this. My only issue is that I wish that there were controlled studies that would suggest, here's how you dose this. You know, here's the way to manage this in the way that won't get you down another road that you can't get past or that you have to go through.
But would
some
people listen to those rules, do you think? I know there are guidelines, but would somebody go, I really like this stuff, and I know it says only take this much, but I love it, so I'm going to take more.
Right,
and,
right.
Right? What do you think?
I don't know yet. I think some people would. Some of us are rule followers,
yeah.
and we would do exactly as we were told. We would treat it like medicine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think it depends on how we look at it. Do we look at it as something recreational that we just do for fun, or do we look at it as something that's managing anxiety or depression or some other symptom, or keeping alcoholism at bay in some situations?
Yep.
He's Dr. John Duffy. He's awesome. He's our show psychologist, although on many other shows too. It's the original here.
But he tries harder on our show,
Wendy.
Does. I've listened to him on the other shows. Not as good, I don't think.
Social media, you can find him. Also go to drjohnduffy.com. Listen to his podcast with his wife, Julie, called Better. And listen tonight on WGN Radio at 11 p.m. You will be on.
Yes, I will. I'm looking forward to it.
It'll be fun.
John. Thank you, guys.
Great to see you.
All right, coming up, the stories that matter with Eric Rung from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom on WGN Radio.